Let me just say that the suggested readings might not obviously fit the theme of with joy give thanks. The passage that was suggested from Jeremiah speaks of the eventual restoration of the nation and the appearance of a wise and a just king, so I guess that could possibly work with the theme of joy. The passage that was read from Psalm 46 speaks of God as our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. So I suppose that could work as well. The suggested passage from Corinthians is a passage that's quite explicit in encouraging people the people of Corinth to be joyfully giving thanks to the Father who has enabled you to share in the inheritance of the saints in the light. So that's pretty obviously, I think, what whoever was responsible for the theme had in mind as the core text for this meditation this morning. The suggested passage from Luke, though, the one that Margaret read, is a bit of a puzzler in terms of joy. It takes place on Good Friday at Jesus' crucifixion. And so I asked myself, where's the joy in that a scene of crucifixion? Where's the joy in the depiction of three men being brutally tortured and subjected to a lingering, horrific death? Where's the joy in the humiliation and mockery of Jesus as he hangs there between two criminals, naked and bleeding? So the Luke passage is naturally where I chose to look for inspiration for the meditation this morning. The passage itself, like so many other passages in the Gospels, has its inherent difficulties related to the fact that it's a little bit out of step with the other Gospel accounts of what happened at the crucifixion, at least to the extent that Luke speaks of things that the others don't. And I'm not going to dwell too much on that discrepancy other than to simply note that none of the other evangelists mention the kinds of details that Luke mentions. For example, no one describes this conversation between Jesus and the criminals who are being crucified with him. John simply states that he was crucified with two others, with no other details about what might have transpired between them, although he does give some details about something else that nobody else mentions, of an interaction between Jesus and his instructions to the disciple that he loved to take care of Jesus' mother. Matthew and Mark state that the criminals were insulting him along with everyone else. There's no hint that one of them is more conciliatory than the other. So Luke is the only one that homes in on this, particularly this criminal who says, remember me. Overall, I'm not going to particularly dwell on the discrepancies because I'm quite happy to recognize that two different witnesses will give two different accounts of the same incident. Although both accounts should be somewhat relatively coherent. But the fact that one evangelist states that both criminals insulted Jesus and another evangelist states that one of them was supportive of Jesus, on the face of it is problematic, I guess. But I suppose one explanation could be that both criminals start out insulting Jesus and then something along the way happens to shift the attitude of one of them. So if we can set aside some of those difficulties of the passage, there are a couple of points that I think one might choose to highlight as offering potential for a sense of joy. In verse 34, for example, in Luke, Jesus says, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing. I think there's some potential for a sense of joy and forgiveness and a recognition that people are acting out of a full understanding of their actions. The other point in the passage that could be an obvious source of joy is Jesus' declaration to one of the criminals that truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. Now, neither of those declarations, forgive them for they don't know what they're doing, you'll be with me today in paradise, are without some minor difficulties of their own. The verse about forgiving them for they know not what they do, unfortunately, might be a later addition to the text. It's apparently not present in many of the oldest and most reliable manuscripts, So there's some sense that it may not have been originally there. So any joy that you can derive from that might be tempered a little bit with the knowledge that it may not, in fact, be a reliable piece of the story. And as for the promise to one of the thieves that he would be with Jesus in paradise, the lack of punctuation in the original Greek could lead to some confusion around what exactly Jesus is promising. Is he saying, truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise, with the comma preceding the word today? Or is he saying, truly, I tell you, today, you will be with me in paradise, with the comma after the word today? In other words, is he saying, I'm telling you that you'll be with me in paradise this very day? Or is he saying, I'm telling you that you will be with me in paradise at some undetermined point in the future? As I said, it's a minor point of difficulty. And it's only really of any concern if you're a bit pedantic like me and you need to know what exactly is being said, or of any concern to you to the degree that it influences what you think happens when one dies. Do we find ourselves immediately in heaven, assuming that that's where we personally are going? Or do we sleep until the resurrection and then find ourselves in heaven? And if I can push the sleep image just a little bit further, when one falls asleep, it seems to me, unless you're dreaming all night, once you fall asleep, the time elapsed between sleeping and waking is kind of irrelevant. Whether you doze off for 8 minutes, or whether you sleep for 8 hours, or whether you sleep for 8 million years, your experience of the period of sleep is more or less instantaneous. You fall asleep, and then bingo, you wake up. Again, maybe not a particularly important point. The more central issue here, I think, is that this criminal is promised a place in paradise, whether the realization of the promise is immediate or not. And that's where I'd like to direct my attention this morning. But as I was preparing this meditation, there were two things that struck me about this person, this criminal, hanging on the cross beside Jesus' cross. First, I've always taken it for granted that this was a man. Some translations certainly state that Jesus was crucified with two men, although some simply state that he was crucified with two others without specifying gender. I think, so I suppose it would be worth mentioning if it was a man and a woman. Maybe it doesn't make any difference. I think it would make a difference to just how we visualize what's happening there in this event. My own ancient Greek is a little bit rusty, but I did try to read through my Greek New Testament. And the Koine Greek actually doesn't say two men. The idea of a man is not there in any of the gospel texts. Although some of the personal prepositions might be masculine, I don't know, my Greek is long gone. And none of the commentators seem to raise the question at all. They don't care. It's two people who are being crucified beside Jesus. Maybe it doesn't matter. But I do think that it shows how much we tend to gloss over details that we otherwise just take for granted. Again, as I've said in other sermons, we tend to see what we expect to see and hear what we expect to hear. But secondly, in preparing for this sermon, as far as I can tell, this criminal is the only person anywhere in the entire gospel accounts, at least before Jesus' resurrection, he's the only person, I think, who really seems to understand that Jesus' kingdom is not of this world. Nowhere else do we get any hint that anybody expects anything other than some sort of a political revolution of sorts. And more than that, he's the only one who seems to understand that this crucifixion will not be the end of the story. His request to Jesus to be remembered when Jesus enters into his kingdom, in spite of the fact that he, Jesus, is dying beside him on a cross, I think is a declaration of faith that even Jesus' closest disciples seem not to have been able to embrace. If they had shared this conviction that Jesus' death on the cross is not the end of the story, they would have been waiting at Jesus' tomb for his resurrection and not huddled away in some room somewhere, trying to keep a low profile from the authorities. And so this criminal, This outcast's humble request for Jesus to be remembered, to remember him, got my imagination going. And I started asking myself, what must it have felt like for Jesus to be hanging there, naked, bleeding, fresh wounds from a flogging, from a crown of thorns, from nails that pierced his hands and his feet? What must it have felt like for Jesus to be the target of insults from the crowd, mockery from the soldiers and from the religious leaders, abandonment from even by even his closest followers? What must it have felt like for Jesus to have a sense of being so terribly alone, so betrayed, and so forsaken, even by God? What must it have felt like for Jesus to turn his head to one side and be cursed and insulted by a man being crucified with him, and to then turn his head to the other side and have this other man who's being crucified with him look him in the eye and say, I know who you are. I know what this has cost you. And I know that you do not deserve this. I know that you do not start and stop on this cross. I know that this is not the end. I know who you are. Please remember me when it becomes clear to everyone else who you really are. What must it have felt like for Jesus to receive these words of encouragement from such an unlikely source? And there's surely cause for joy in that moment when Jesus realizes finally someone who understands. Finally someone I can look at and know that I too am seen, really seen for who I am. I know that my imagination can run amok sometimes, but I can't help thinking that this particular interaction has to have been one of the most intimate exchanges that Jesus has ever had with anyone else in the gospel accounts. He's dying. He's only hours removed from the Garden of Gethsemane, where he sweat blood in anticipation of what's happening now. He's only moments away from crying out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? This person beside him is also dying. And they're both in agony of physical pain and surely an agony of spirit as well. This is not a moment of casual banter. It's not a fleeting exchange of pleasantries or polite encouragement to each other. It's not a, everything's going to turn out all right. It's not that. And I sometimes think that when we read passages like this, we kind of get lost in the theological explanations of what's going on to the detriment of an appreciation of the human drama of the occasion and to a diminishing of the humanity of those involved. The story being told otherwise kind of takes on the feel of a very distant historical or theological treatise of some kind, and we lose sight of the fact that this robber on the cross beside Jesus had a name. He certainly wasn't an angel, he was a robber, he was a thief. But he wasn't a demon either. Perhaps he had a family that needed to be fed. He certainly had hopes and aspirations for his own life. But he finds himself hoisted up on a cross, crucified beside two other men, humiliated and shamed. And yet this robber, in these final moments of his own life, is able to look at Jesus, have a measure of pity, I think, for someone who doesn't deserve this punishment, knowing fully well that he himself deserves everything by the mores of the day, deserves everything that's happening to him, but to have a measure of pity for the man beside him who doesn't deserve this and tell him what he needed to hear at that moment. In spite of all the evidence to the contrary, I know that this is not the end. I know that you will yet come into your kingdom. Please remember me when you do. And I think there's reason to believe that Jesus may have enjoyed by this man's simple faith. I think there's cause to see in this short exchange, and in particular Jesus' response to this man, a glimpse into Jesus' humanity and a glimpse into his divinity. I think I can read between the lines of the words written by Luke and hear Jesus' answer to this criminal. Thank you for your trust. Thank you for your faith. Thank you for this request to me. And yes, I will remember you. And in spite of the circumstances of the day, I'm sure there was surely joy in the heart of this criminal as well. Thank you.